Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Another weekend, another graphically violent video that has surfaced. This time, it captures an incident on the CTA on the Red Line, which has become the midnight meat train, as far as I can tell, based on, I certainly don't take it, not looking for confrontation, but that certainly seems to be the reporting from police as well as those unfortunate souls who do have to take it to get around town. Oh, and by the way, before you hear from Triple Threat and Spalding about racism, this is black individuals who violate a black gentleman, younger versus older. Criminals and victims. Criminals and victims. That's what we're talking about. Not black, white, or other. Here's what happened on that fateful Red Line. This guy is sitting in the seat, and three individuals roll up on him and start by demanding money. Then it escalates.
Oh my God, Charmaine.
And so what you heard there, if I can provide some context, is the three roll up on him and can I get $5? Where's your wallet at? Let me see your ID. Then two of them reach into this man's pockets. Woman pulls out a wine bottle from his pocket, from the victim in the case. And then they go through his pockets and you hear the one guy saying to his friend, Charmaine, get back. Then it's the woman who takes the wine bottle and smashes the bottle onto the guy's head who's just sitting there. This is being filmed, right? This is not like security footage. This is being filmed while they're doing it.
Because it's for sport.
Then when they pan back, the bottle doesn't break over his head, but when they pan back, he's holding his head, he's rocking back and forth. And then you see the blood starting to stream down his forehead. The guy did nothing. He did not resist. He stood up. He set his hands back. He was allowing them to go through his pockets. He did not push back at all. And then he was sitting down while they were still accosting him. And then she took this bottle that she had pulled from inside his jacket, and she struck him with it. And then they walked off the train.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, this is the reason why. No parents, because we don't have buses, we have the CTA. And no one in their right mind allows their kids anymore to go on the CTA. The Red Line, the Brown Line, the Blue Line. Because it's not if it's one, you're going to get mugged.
And if you saw this video, or if you haven't, you should check it out.
It's sickening.
Because what you see there are some honor students committing non-detainable offenses. That's the new paradigm starting January 1 in Illinois under the Purge Law, otherwise known as the Safety Act, that Governor Pritzker signed into law. And this is, as I said, getting national, really international attention. And that got amplified thanks to Joe Rogan in his most recent podcast. He is talking to Will Harris. Will Harris is his guest, who's a filmmaker and Chicago native, actually. And they talk about the Safety Act, the Purge Law here. And here's how that went.
Crazy.
The Purge.
The Safety Law. It's they're essentially eliminating cash bail for almost everything dangerous. Kidnapping, they're eliminating cash bail for second-degree murder. They're eliminating cash bail for murder through narcotics. So you could, like, overdose someone and drug them to death and no cash bail. Intimidating an official, like a federal official, or here it is. Here's the things. The law includes secondary murder, arson, so you could light a guy's house on fire, get right out of jail, drug-induced homicide, robbery, kidnapping, aggravated battery, burglary, intimidation, aggravated driving under the influence, fleeing and eluding drug offenses, and threatening a public official. No bail.
What? I'm from Illinois.
It's crazy. I mean, everyone's freaking out. I'm very concerned about the increase in violent crime. Again, I do want to stress there's still time to fix it. And the state's attorneys are working very hard. We have been for the last year and a half to fix this law. It's very fixable. We could still eliminate cash bail, but make sure the right people are in custody and everybody who's not in danger gets out, said state's attorney Robert Berlin.
And then he went on to say they're fracked. I don't know why that got cut off. Well, we're fracked if we decide that this will stand. Being fracked or not fracked is up to us, I would say. But it's, and by the way, Bob Berlin, with all due respect to DuPage County State Attorney, you've heard him on this show.
Yeah.
It's not fixable. It's not fixable. I know there's these state's attorneys that are meeting with legislators. They're being shined on by these legislators and this governor. They're trying to buy time to get through the election so they can do nothing come veto session. And anybody who's been around for 5 minutes would know that. It is not fixable. There's no intention to fix it because this is the work product of anti-police decarceration ideologues. Not everybody who voted for it, not everybody who doesn't understand the law, although that's fewer and fewer people with each passing day, thanks to Greg Gutfeld and Joe Rogan, Bernie Bro. Joe Rogan, by the way, Bernie Bro, Joe Rogan, and a lot of other people across the political spectrum who have pushed this conversation. We're effed. We don't have to be. But we are if this stays in effect, if this goes into effect January 1, if this remains the law, as it were, and if the people in charge with making it the law are not held accountable. It's so simple. When you watch that video of that guy being hit with a wine bottle on the red line, or you watch the video of that woman being attacked in Lakeview, just remember, civilization is on the ballot on November 8th, and nothing less than that.
Well, it's a city where criminals have free reign, and they know they're only going to be empowered more come January 1st.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender, Signature Bank.
Mobile.
See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Greg Hines reporting in Crane Chicago Business, the anti-business business rag in Chicago. Pritzker says Daily Herald candidates forum is back on. He confirms Yay. That he's decided to participate in the candidate forum this Friday, September 30th.
Oh, what time did that come out? Because earlier in the day, he was still deciding.
Mm-hmm. So once the Daily Herald and the publisher of the Daily Herald, Paddock Publications, announced that it was breaking its contract with the group to which I'm affiliated with, that and with respect to producing newspapers that many of you have received, and
I have a 7-year relationship with Paddock Publications,
printing for a long time, online for a long time. There's nothing new about these outlets. They're just pretending it's new for the purposes of their phony moral indignation. Once Paddock Publications announced they wouldn't print the papers anymore, now it's back on. And, of course, the response is to say, well, thank you, Your Magnificence, for agreeing to participate in a forum where jesters of your court will ask you contrived questions and do the best to rough up your opponent, Darren Bailey. What an honor it is that you've deigned to participate in a candidate forum, because, as we said on Friday, these things to Pritzker about him, not about the electorate.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I went there to ask him that, and I said, since Paddock Publications abruptly ended their 7-year relationship with Chicago City Wire and other public newspapers, now will you do the Daily Herald candidate forum? And if not, why? And just know that his sister, who wears the pants in this family, is sitting 2 seats away from him.
So we're looking at that, actually. That's we wanted to see some change there. But that is absolutely something that we're considering again.
We'll wrap it up.
Thank you.
Everybody clap. And then later, 2 hours later, he had a different press conference with his sister not there.
I think that they had a challenge that they had to address of, of the appearance on the one hand, integrity in journalism, and on the other hand, publishing something that is full of lies and innuendo and personal attacks and even with a tinge of racism. And so I think it was the right move on their part, a smart move on their part.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does that mean you're going to do it? The follow up there?
Considering that now.
Well, the
now it's a tinge of racism.
It's a tinge. We're improving. They have to be properly contrite. And so it took a little while for him to get over his hurt feelings. And then it was made clear that he will participate over the weekend. And that's a wonderful thing.
What a joke. I mean, he acts like a king. And if people can't see through that, then you're stupid.
Did we get the specifics on the lies and the innuendos? Can you give us a substantive, specific example?
I said, speaking of those newspapers, can you specifically point to one story that is inaccurate? Wrap it up. We got to go. People start clapping.
Yeah. No, of course. Don't be the first one to stop clapping.
No. Old man before in front of me sitting there, he turns around and he says, well, he didn't answer your question. And I said to him, well, welcome to my world.
Yeah.
He never answers a question.
The real question is,
if you can even get one in.
Why is only one person asking it? Yeah, okay. All right. So
we're saved. We can sleep now at night knowing that he's going to participate in the Daily Herald candidate forum.
That's wonderful. As I mentioned on Friday, and I'll mention again, the papers will continue. Paddock Publications isn't the only printer in the Western world, and they've already been replaced. They'll continue, and now we're increasing the distribution.
Good.
Just to make the point and make sure more people have exposure to it. See, here's the thing about Jelly Belly and the new Marxists in charge of the Democrat Socialist Party is they just don't want anybody to have their say if their say isn't consistent with what is being said by them. It's just really that simple. And point of fact, there was a good piece in the New York Post about Democrats sick of the radical left switching sides, for example, and particularly among Gen Z. It was really interesting. One of the individuals they spoke with, Holden Collada, 20-year-old bartender, college freshman from Connecticut, put off by the current Democratic Party. Looking back at the party in the 80s and 90s, I think I probably would have been a Democrat. I realized both sides just look like a clown show, and we were kind of missing the point. Today, I find myself in the disaffected center. I take some ideas from the left and some from the right, but I don't feel like I identify with any tribe. One big problem with the Democrats, he said, is that they lean a lot more towards censorship.
Huh.
I see self-censorship all the time. People whisper, oh, yeah, I agree with you, but I could never say that. And that sort of chilling of free expression is not something that he thinks is okay. I think a lot of the cultural things left is talking about today are really alienating. If we're only talking about pronouns, we're not really solving issues or moving the country forward. Yeah, no kidding. Oh, and then there's other issues, too, like personal safety. Former Democrat Michael Lee re-registered as a libertarian in January of last year. Now the 33-year-old says there are definitely those who are too woke and too left in my taste and alienating centrists like me. As a husband and father of one who's concerned for his family's safety, especially turned off by the party's loudest left-wing members such as Ilhan Omar and AOC calling to defund the police in the wake of the George Floyd killing. Defunding the police may have been a new catchy slogan, but as an actual stance, it's highly impractical and will cause more problems. Yeah, well, there's some people that are just observing objective reality over the last 2 years, and it's important to point out, particularly in the personal safety piece, that this isn't just about New York's no cash bail law or Illinois' no cash bail law and turning over the streets to criminals over the last year and prospectively in the case of Illinois statewide. We've done it in Chicago and Cook County and then, of course, prospectively what we're looking at. It's going back to exactly what that former Democrat went back to, the summer of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Have you forgotten the summer of 2020? I know Chicago hasn't because it's not recovered, the downtown. You know, two times the city was laid siege to, and the defund the police antics that were going on by Black Lives Matter and patronizing sympathetic, improperly sympathetic or empathetic politicians, including some gooey pea hat wearing, quote unquote, Republicans in the suburbs, politicians I'm talking about. Have you forgotten that? You have to trace it back to that. That was a break point. And then you got the Safety Act here. You got the de Blasio Cuomo-inspired no cash bail in New York. That you have to go back to the summer rioting and looting and lawlessness in 2020. And then the politicians getting in the back of that parade of mayhem, come up with, let's turn the criminals out of our prisons. Just going back on the papers for a second. The Illinois Federation of Teachers, IFT, one of teachers' unions, don't be fooled by fake news. They've put out this missive. Groups like Illinois Policy Institute, Illinois News Network, media organizations run by Dan Prof, produce newspapers and websites that spread biased, often false information disguised as news. Oh, we're sometimes true. We only a tinge racist and we're sometimes true. We're improving. Here, we have compiled this list of illegitimate news sources. Illegitimate news sources. And it's Illinois Policy Institute, Franklin News Foundation, which would include Illinois News Network, Illinois Radio Network, all the newspapers you've seen. Salem Radio, 60 Seconds of Sanity.
Commentaries. You don't do those anymore, though, do you?
I haven't done one in a while, but that's
but
on
they're
the,
on you.
They're on the list. They
Are
made
they
the
really?
List. And also our entire station, AFSCC, the answer.
Yeah.
We're on the Don't Be Fooled by Fakes News list.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. Can I see that? Because that's not...
You know, and...
That's good for my second job.
Yeah, and then...
This is not good.
It's wonderful. And, you know, the next step is to just have it the improper, the legitimate news publicly financed, which is what Democrat socialists have been attempting to do, both at the local level as well as the federal level. Make everything NPR. Have the government be your partner in truth.
Yeah.
That's where this is going, and that's where they want it to go. One more really deliciously ironic postscript on this. So Pritzker, in addition to trying to stop the newspapers, has been trying to stop advertisements on television and radio. And so he sent the cease and desist letter to all the stations last week about the Beverly Miles ad. Have you seen the Beverly Miles ad? She's the
retired Army major,
ran against him in the Democrat primary for governor.
Yeah, they told her either quit your job, no, quit the campaign, or quit your job.
Right. She's a nurse at the Heinz VA.
Yeah, but that's during a time when nurses were heroes and we needed nurses because people were dying. Mm-hmm. Remember? Hug a nurse. Put up a sign, heroes work here.
So this is just, you just cannot make it up. It's not, you cannot parody what's happening. The legal representation for Pritzker, who's been in contact with these news stations. Oh, and by the way, I know, you know, these dum-dums in the Chicago Press Corps think that the ads have been, the Beverly Miles ad have been taken down. They have not. Have not. We're winning the argument. But who's making the argument on behalf of Pritzker?
Who?
The Elias Law Group. Elias Law Group. Does that ring a bell? It should. Mark Elias is the principal there. Mark Elias is Mr. Russian collusion. He is Mr. Steele dossier. He was the cutout between the campaign and Steele for all of the fake news, misinformation, conspiracy theorizing about Trump, feeding the intel community, feeding obviously the DC press corps for lo the last many years. Mark Elias is representing J.B. Pritzker to complain about my misinformation. Does it get better than that? Does it get richer than that? The king of misinformation is decrying alleged misinformation, which is all documentable, has been documented, and which they can't point specifically to, unlike, for example, the Steele dossier and Mark Elias's misinformation, his pink slime, which he does for a living, which we can point to with great specificity and have spent years doing so. David in Winnetka, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, with all the craziness that's ensuing with, you know, violence being acceptable, you know, well, you know, if it's Democratic on red, but with all this going on and the safety coming out and blah, 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 what's going to be done for the victim? What law is going to be rewritten on, say, rules of engagement when you feel your life's endangered or threatened, or if the whole thing needs to be revamped? Kind of like, all right, hey, if you're going to be able, allowed to, you know, kill me, I should have, you know, an easier right to defend myself.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, thanks for the call. This is where, this is where right to carry comes in. And this is something that we said often, and maybe it's more real than it was, than it's ever been, which is what we said often during the arguments for concealed carry, for right to carry. You may not want to ever be put in this position, but you may be put in the position. And so you have to be prepared for it. You may be put in a position where you have to protect yourself. I never want to be in that position. Well, that choice is not always, and often not, yours alone, as we see playing out in the streets of Chicago. And so, yeah, you better prepare for it. And when you have politicians talking about the way it's being covered rather than what's happening, that tells you they're not interested in stopping what's happening. And you should take note of that, too.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, I came across this interview that Sylvester Stallone did with the BBC shortly after the release of Rocky in 1977.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting cultural commentary. It was Stallone talking about where America was at that point, and Hollywood, why he did that script. And I wonder if there's some resonance to where America is some, you know, 45 years later.
You've written several scripts before, but was there any special reason for you to write this one, to write Rocky?
Well, I felt at the time that cinema, at least the movies I had been seeing, were at an all-time low. Everything was anti-society, anti-Christ, anti-government, anti-everything, and there was no one to root for. And I also feel that films are very cyclic, so I wanted to get back into the cycle of the films of the 40s and the 50s, where people say, hey, gee, I missed the good old films, yet Hollywood hasn't taken heed and hasn't made any good old-fashioned type films where morality was at the forefront. So I took the opportunity to write this particular film, of course, being somewhat selfish because I had myself in mind for it. But that was the main motivation.
Hmm. Yeah.
Something to cheer for.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Chris Rufo over at the Manhattan Institute brings us this. The National Teachers Union, the NEA, 3 million public school teachers, 14,000 local school districts, National Education Association, largest teachers union in the country. Their LGBTQ plus caucus has created a website and badge for public school employees that promote non-binary identities, a how-to guide for quote-unquote queer sex, and the argument that transgender men can get pregnant. This is Rufo explaining on Tucker Carlson's show last week.
So what's happened is that the teachers union has created badges for public school teachers with a QR code on the back that links them to these resources, including this resource on queering sex ed. The idea is that traditional sexual education is white, male, heterosexual focused. And in order to empower students and empower LGBTQ plus students, you have to teach them about the whole range of sex acts, including sadomasochism, bonding, rimming. And then this, I'll show you because it's almost unbelievable. This is actually a guide designed to, quote, empower youth on fisting, which they define as putting a fist or whole hand into a person's vagina or bum. I agree, this should be a crime. Any adult government employee that talks about these things with kids should be immediately fired. But that's not what's happening. This is the teachers union official ideology. They've taken the principles of radical gender theory from the universities, and now they're mainlining it into the K-12 system without parents' consent, without parents' knowledge. And this is the kind of resource that in many cases, including in schools in Ohio, teachers are actually wearing this resource as a badge that links directly to these materials.
Teachers wearing badges with QR codes.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proantalon. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
The QR codes on the badges point to the NEA's LGBTQ plus caucus website with resources like Rufo is describing. I'm looking at them right now. He posted them. This is, and he mentioned, it's just to be specific, Hilliard City School District in Hilliard, Ohio, for example, happening. In this queering sex ed document, it's a program of Planned Parenthood Toronto. Of course it is. Planned Parenthood. That wonderful organization that promotes women's health. Really. Sex acts that don't get enough play. Page one. Anal sex.
Ew.
And there are steps. There are ingredients. There are substitutions. There are notes for guidance. Literally, five steps on the sex acts that don't get enough play. Number one, anal sex. This is for K through 12, which necessarily includes K through 8 sex, in quote-unquote, in quotations, ed. Is it starting to take hold? Do you understand where things are? Page two, bondage. Have you had the bondage conversation with your third grader yet?
No, I never had it with any of my children.
Ingredients, rope, ribbon, scarves, safe word and clear boundaries, a blank ton of consent. The steps. Rimming, page three. Ingredients, substitutions, notes, steps. Page four, domination. Have you had the domination conversation with your kindergartner yet? How many people, and domination is one, and then sadomasochism on page four. The ingredients, the options, toys like whips and chains. The steps. Page five, sexting. Yeah. Have you encouraged your grade schooler to start sexting yet? Maybe get on Snapchat so they can upload child porn. That's page five is sexting. Page six is fingering. Is this making people feel uncomfortable? Why? It's part of your kid's curriculum.
What ages again?
This is the NEA. This is for kids. It's for minors. Why are you
it's
uncomfortable?
It's even gross if you talked about it with adults.
Why are you uncomfortable?
Let alone our children.
Page seven, muffing.
What the heck does that mean? Or is this a conversation Justin's going to have with me? Muffing.
Using fingers or other objects to stimulate a trans woman or male assigned at birth person internally.
Okay.
Do you want more details?
Because
no, they have steps.
Oh my God. Let
There's
me
steps.
That. Ew. Uh-huh.
Do you want the shopping list for the ingredients to cook this up? Page.
The title says sex acts that don't get enough play.
Don't get enough play. Because these are things to be celebrated, and
well, why are they
you need instruction.
That in school? That is none of their gosh darn business.
Page eight is masturbation, and page nine is fisting, as Chris Rufo previewed. Not kidding, right here, waving it around. That's sex acts that don't get enough play. Part of the NEIA's LGBTQIA caucus. Part of the documents they're putting online for teachers, administrators, principals to incorporate into the classroom. Here's a from Teen Health Source, another resource on the site. What does queering sex ed look like? It's inclusive. It's accessible. It's sex positive. It includes trans and cis people. It's asexual positive. It doesn't assume identity. Youth positive. Body positive. Empowering. Oh, this is very empowering. There's nothing more empowering than masochism. For example, opens rather than closes possibilities. Indeed, so accounts for pleasure. It's awesome. Those are the attributes of queering sex ed. Resources created through queering sex ed include introduction, language and definitions, other identities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. and you have all these, you know, start, just, you know, get active. Get active in the process of queering sex ed. Learn and experiment. Is anybody unclear about the range of negative impacts of sexualizing children? Have we forgotten what we understand to be true? Is anyone, I mean, I know the NEA and these other cultural Marxists are unclear or just uninterested in the impacts because their job, per their ideology, is to separate kids from their parents, which they're doing. But I mean, for like just the rational, sensible person out there, is there any confusion about the impact of this kind of stuff on kids in terms of their intellectual, social, emotional development? And to the extent that they go down any of these roads, particularly before the age of consent, the often lasting impacts.
Well, I remember when I had sex ed, they taught abstinence and celebrated that. And with that pamphlet you just showed.
Now they celebrate anal sex, bondage, and rimming. So it's moved a little bit away from that,
yeah,
hasn't it?
A tad bit.
Phil and Wheaton, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, my comment would be, so years ago, you know, as a kid, you hear jokes about the pedophiles or, you know, gay men would go into the priesthood and they would try to hide themselves. And you kind of accepted that, you know, it was a stereotype. But it seems now that the teaching profession is actually attracting pedophiles and these just odd, strange, creepy people that now get to have their captive audience, 8, 9, 10-year-olds, and pretty much it's child abuse, just abusing the children, and the teachers' unions back them up. We got Sean Kasten in Downers Grove. He's promoting the drag queen show at the public library, and there's just some sick people out there.
Yeah, and they're in charge of our cultural and civic institutions. Thanks for the call, Phil. Remember the story in the Tribune? Can I go back to that? This expose in the Chicago Tribune about CPS from, I don't know, 5 years ago now. The rampant sexual abuse of children that was occurring in CPS, where the city's corp council admitted, and it was a review of just like a 5-year period, like 2013 to 2018. I'm going from memory here, but it was a 5-year period. And the city's corp council conceded the Tribune's analysis based on the information they were able to call from the school district, more than 500 legitimate cases, mm-hmm, where there was a basis for the complaint of sexual violation of some sort in CPS. And I know we said, well, that's a big school. No, I know 500 complaints is a big number too. And all you need is one person like that Nasser creep, who is the, you know, the doc,
Larry Nasser,
the,
yeah,
doc for the gymnast, to go unchecked to abuse dozens and dozens, hundreds of kids. I don't know. Does this register? The Tribune article, the Tribune expose is really what it was. That didn't register at all.
No.
That got no play.
Nobody cared. Nobody talked to us during the summertime when all the, you know, liberal Chicagoans were at their second homes, their summer homes.
I wonder why.
Michigan.
I wonder why that got no play.
Because maybe it has CPS look bad.
Maybe it has something to do with, again, who is in charge of our cultural and civic institutions and what their disposition is towards this sort of thing. As you have people in this camp trying at present, as we've documented, provided examples, trying to mainstream pedophilia, right? These are maps.
Yeah, maps.
Uh-huh. Minor attracted persons. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you have stories like this. Wanderlinger Brewery Company hosted the Chattanooga Pride Youth Day. Video at this family-friendly brewery in Texas. Young girl is patting down the crotch area of an adult dressed as Ariel from Disney's Little Mermaid. There's a video of this. Promoted by the Chattanooga Pride, Tennessee Valley Pride, an organization celebrating, say with me, diversity in Chattanooga. Happy Chattanooga Pride, kids. Okay. I mean, this is why we have Glenn Youngkin in Virginia promoting this essentially parental right protocol that schools in Virginia must adopt in spirit. You know, they can take whatever form it wants, but it must adopt in spirit. You're not allowed to cut the parents out of what's going on within the schools, particularly when it comes to things like their identity, which implicates their physical as well as social and emotional health. So are you ready to start demanding that here against the backdrop of these Orwellian media literacy and culturally responsive curriculum demands of this regime that we have? You don't think CPS and these other school districts in the suburbs dominated by these same sort of cultural Marxists, you don't think they'll be afraid to, you think they'll be afraid to incorporate this? If you think that, then you're not paying attention. Chris in Barrington.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. My wife is a teacher. Actually, I believe she teaches at your alma mater, Amy, River Trails Elementary School. Mm-hmm. And she has gotten out of the NEA. I mean, we get the mailings, and it's just getting sicker and sicker. And it's just unbelievable. My wife is a teacher. She loves her kids. And everybody else is fighting to take away these kids. They want to take them from their parents, and they want to groom them, you know. And it's getting unbelievable, and she can't handle it. She cannot stop. She cannot stop fighting for these kids because it's crazy. We fight every Tuesday, every monthly Tuesday at our school board meeting in Barrington where our kids are school, and it's a lost cause. They're all groomers there. They accept this, and it's okay. And they've already said that. And unfortunately, I think it's a lost cause. But it's sickening what's going on.
Thanks.
And I feel bad for these teachers who really care.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Well, by popular demand, because we played this clip on Friday and we got so much response on it, I want to play it again. People asking us to send us the clip so they can share it and so forth. This guy, Mario, who's part of the group Gays Against Groomers, or Gays Against Grooming, he went to the Conejo school district board meeting at the behest of some parent that reached out to Gays Against Grooming. And he apparently has a niece or nephew at the school district. I can't remember which. But this was his address to the school board, this gay gentleman, Mario.
Good evening. My name is Mario Presents, and I'm here as a representative from Gays Against Groomers Coalition with over 250,000 followers across social media and as the uncle of two students in your district. It has come to our attention that the district intends to teach transgenderism to children under the age of 10 without parental consent. If I were to teach your child about my sexuality without your consent or involvement, I'd be arrested. But when the school district does it, it's education. Districts are teaching transgenderism when they should be teaching science, math, and language. Instead, teachers are hiding student pronouns from their parents under the guise of gender affirmation. Can you imagine the uproar if schools were evangelizing or baptizing children without parental consent? Isn't that sort of what you're doing? You don't tuck these children in at night. You don't teach them to stand up to bullies. You don't pay their medical bills. And you certainly don't hold their hands in the hospital. These parents do. Simple truths based in science need to be upheld for our society to flourish. The gross indoctrination we're seeing is creating a lifetime of medication and hormones because you can't simply pause puberty. Men cannot become women, and sex chromosomes are encoded into the fabric of our DNA. Simply affirming a teenager's gender is akin to affirming anorexia. Both are body dysmorphic disorders, yet we don't teach the starving teenagers how to binge and purge or affirm that they are indeed overweight. However, school districts, including yours, seem to have no issue secretly teaching girls that they can be boys because they feel uncomfortable in their bodies. A grown adult woman can't get a hysterectomy without extensive medical forms and doctor's visits. But Dr. Safir, over the hill in Sherman Oaks, is willing to do top and bottom surgery, sterilizing children for life. Parents must be a part of the education process when teaching sexuality to students, and it definitely doesn't need to happen under the age of 10 years old.
Mic drop. And the response you hear from the parents in the audience tells you that it's not a lost cause. And how can you let it be a lost cause when it's your kids and our civilization on the line?
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss Freedom Summit Chicago on November 5th. Get your tickets today before they sell out. Go to freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Alex Tabarrok, economist over at George Mason University, alerted my attention to this story posted over at Marginal Revolution, the blog that he and Tyler Cohen do. A white supremacist under every bed is the title of his post, and that's what we have here. Today we live under the white supremacist scare, the irrational fear that there's a white supremacist under every bed. Yeah, I wonder who's fomenting that irrationality. I mean, maybe the Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, calling half the country semi-fascist. Merrick Garland and law enforcement dutifully running around suggesting that domestic terrorists, like parents who attend school board meetings, present the greatest threat to security, internal security in the country. An email sent to the University of Virginia students warns, events have occurred on grounds that have been cause for concern, quotation. And, quote, the nature and timing of these events have caused some to speculate they are linked or part of a larger pattern of racially motivated crimes. Here is one such event. Last weekend, University of Virginia campus, several community members reported that a flag bearing a symbol that looked like either a crown or an owl, depending on how the flag is held, was left on the grass near the Memorial to Enslaved Laborers. What, like Starbucks baristas? What is that memorial? But anyway, the same person also left a check for $888.88 that was ultimately delivered as a surprise to a student's room. And the check had the same symbol that was on the flag.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, it's like an episode of X-Files,
yes.
Isn't it? As rumors swirled around the bizarre set of events, some speculated the flag represented a white supremacist organization, and the check was somehow a targeted act of intimidation against a student of color. Wait till the reveal.
I can't wait.
But first, Tabarrok's commentary, which is great. A crown, an owl, a check for $888.88. Heil Hitler!
Is that what he wrote?
Yeah. It seems odd that giving a check to someone is targeting a person of color.
Yeah, you're inviting them into a sorority or fraternity?
But no matter, because logic isn't important here. What else could this mean besides white supremacy? Bear in mind, this is a university where streaking the lawn is a tradition, and there are weird numbers, signs, and images all over campus. The University of Virginia Police and the FBI... Yes, the FBI were called to investigate. There isn't even any alleged crime here.
Wait, and what was it? A key? An owl?
A flag with an owl or a crown, depending on how the flag was waving at the time, and the mysterious check
for $888.88.
Uh-huh.
Plot thickens.
So what happened?
So now the cops are involved in the FBI.
The FBI.
The University of Virginia.
This is the FBI keeping us safe. Rooting out domestic terrorism.
I can't wait to find out what this is.
We discovered, they found out, they found the culprit.
Oh, so, okay. Has an arrest been made? Or?
Well, no, because
there was no crime.
Because they found out that he is part of an organization that focuses on microphilanthropy that occasionally engages in random acts of kindness to Kurdish students, like sending a check. That's it.
Oh, boy.
So it's a commentary on the left, because who's in charge of these universities, including University of Virginia. It's also a commentary on the FBI. And so is this. A well-known pro-life author, sidewalk counselor, and father of seven was the subject of a Department of Justice FBI SWAT raid and arrest at his rural home as his kids looked on screaming. 25 to 30 FBI agents swarmed this guy's property outside of Philadelphia. I guess he's about 2 hours outside of Philadelphia because he drives 2 hours south to Philadelphia every Wednesday to sidewalk counsel for outside of abortion mills for 6 to 8 hours. His wife, who's a homeschool mom, explained, SWAT team, 25 to 30 FBI agents swarmed their property with around 15 vehicles at 7:05 in the morning last week. Having quickly surrounded the house with rifles in firing position, they started pounding on the door and yelling for us to open. The raid of this Catholic pro-life activist in Pennsylvania stems from events in October of last year at an abortion clinic. According to the, this guy's name is Mark Hauk, founder and president of the King's Men, which promotes healing for victims of pornography addiction, promotes Christian virtues among men in the United States and Europe. Oh, the horror of it. According to his wife, on several occasions last year, her husband took the eldest of his seven children, then age 12, to an abortion clinic where he went to counsel mothers planning to abort their children. For weeks and weeks, a pro-abortion protester got in her son's face screaming crude, inappropriate, and disgusting things such as, "Your dad is a blank," pejorative for a gay person. The tolerance of the left on display, and other statements too vile for mom to repeat. She said her husband repeatedly told the man he didn't have permission to speak to his 12-year-old son, asked him to stop. He kept doing it and kind of came into their son's personal space as he continued to shout obscenities. Mark shoved him away from his 12-year-old son. The guy fell back. He didn't have any injuries or anything, but he tried to sue Mark. And that necessitates an FBI raid?
Almost a year later. That's called harassment.
Importantly, no charges were filed locally. But here's what Merrick Garland's DOJ had to say. The charges stem from two separate incidents in October of 2021, which occurred at the Planned Parenthood Elizabeth Blackwell Health Center on Locust Street in Philly, where Hoke allegedly assaulted the victim, a 72-year-old man identified in the indictment by initials. He was a volunteer escort at the reproductive health care clinic. In the first incident, this guy was attempting to escort two patients exiting the clinic while the defendant forcefully shoved him to the ground. In the second incident, the defendant verbally confronted him and forcefully shoved him to the ground, causing injuries that required medical attention. Uh-huh. So he was arrested, and he appeared in federal court charged with violating the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances FACE Act, which is a federal statute and makes it a federal crime to use force with the intent to injure, intimidate, or interfere with anyone because the person is a provider of reproductive health care, translation, abortion on demand. Right. Okay, so there's two different stories here about what happened. But let's say that what Merrick Garland's DOJ said happened is exactly what happened. Let's say that this Christian pro-lifer sidewalk counselor in his late 40s, let's say that that's what he did. I don't believe that's what he did. I don't believe the Department of Justice. But let's, for the sake of argument, say that's what he did. So a pro-lifer and a pro-abort got into a pushing match outside of a abortion mill in Philadelphia. And that requires 25 to 30 FBI agents, guns drawn, dragging somebody out of their house in front of their children at 7 in the morning. Is that a proportional response to any perceived threat? Is that rational?
312-642-5600 turnkey.proanswerline 64636 type in DA, then a quick comment. It sounds like an abuse of power, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's can he sue the FBI?
Oh, well, we certainly can, depending on you know what he is able to prove about the incident or incidents in question. If what his wife is saying is accurate, he better.
But there was no local charges, so why is this elevated to the feds? Because they don't like what he's doing.
It's very strange.
They want to intimidate him. Yes.
Very strange. Yeah, because
they
want
to stop it.
Because a prayerful pro-life activist, and that's what I suspect he is. Prayerful pro-life activist who is not liked by the powers that be because he's a prayerful pro-life activist. This is a threat to the republic. You disagree, you're a threat to the republic. You actively disagree. In other words, you don't just disagree quietly to yourself, but you take action. You're an activist in some way. Well, you know what you are then. Hillary Clinton told you. Did you hear Hillary over the weekend? At this Texas Tribune gathering of leftists. Texas, just as a quick aside, media. Texas Tribune, which was founded by this leftist billionaire named John Thornton, who used to be the head of Goldman Sachs. Of course he's a leftist. And this pretends to be like nonpartisan, nonprofit news outlet. Hard left. You want to talk about pink slime. And by the way, Thornton is like the chairman of the board of the Brookings Institution, left-wing think tank. But it's not part. Everything the left does is nonpartisan. And everybody who disagrees with them is an extremist. You understand the dynamic, how that works. Mm-hmm. Here's Hillary Clinton on you listening. It's many of you. And me.
I remember as a young student, trying to figure out how did people get basically drawn in by Hitler? How did that happen? And I'd watch newsreels and I'd see this guy standing up there ranting and raving and people shouting and raising their arms. I thought, what's happened to these people? Why did they believe that? You saw the rally in Ohio the other night. Trump is there ranting and raving for more than an hour, and you have these rows of young men with their arms raised. I thought, what is going on? So there is a real pressure, and I think it is fair to say we're in a struggle between democracy and autocracy.
Yeah, didn't you catch the beer hall pooch in Ohio the other week? Hitler Youth. That's who attends Trump rallies. You get it? The new Hitler Youth. And that would certainly include anybody who's pro-life and Christian oriented on top of it. Boy, talk about a double whammy. Oh, by the way, you think it's just me? You think it's just you? It's not. Rasmussen polling, 53% of likely voters come November 8th agree to this statement. Quote, there is a group of politicized thugs at the top of the FBI that are using the FBI as Joe Biden's personal Gestapo. Speaking of Third Reich references, the majority of the country. Mm-hmm. Catherine in St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Your situation that you just talked about, I heard about the other day, because I'm very involved in pro-life in the Aurora area, out at that Planned Parenthood in Aurora, in Aurora. And anything that happens out there is totally on camera. There's probably 15 cameras.
Yeah.
On the side of that building where we stand. So there should be absolutely no dispute about what's going on at any of those facilities for their protection and for our protection. So I just wanted to let you know about that.
That's a good point.
That is a really
Thanks
good
for the
point.
Call, Catherine.
Yeah, well, where's the footage of it?
We'll see what
this happened.
We'll see what the federal government has. Speaking of the FBI, continuing to speak about the FBI, one more case we'll get to. And then we'll talk about this a little bit more with Jim Carafano at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. This FBI is really something. FBI whistleblower named Steve Friend fired for not going along with the program. Miranda Devine, friend of the show, New York Post columnist, was on with Tucker last week describing the Steve Friend saga.
Well, I learned that Stephen Friend, FBI special agent still serving, who was suspended on Monday, is an American hero. You know, he had the dream job. He's been with the FBI for 12 years. He's a SWAT team member. But he just could not live with his conscience after he was dragged off these very important child porn, child exploitation, human trafficking investigations that he was working on, and put on these really bogus January 6 cases that just serve to, I guess, back up the rhetoric that we're hearing from the White House that domestic terrorism is the worst threat to America since the Civil War. And so he could see from on the ground how the FBI Washington field office was manipulating these cases to try and expand and pretend that the problem was bigger than it was. And he also didn't want to participate in SWAT raids on people who had just were being, you know, accused of misdemeanors at worst, innocent American citizens. And, you know, they were being told to investigate people who hadn't even gone to Washington, D.C. that day. In one case, a man had been at his son's funeral that day, yet he had FBI agents knocking on his door. People were being surveilled. This is just such an abuse of their civil rights. And Steve Friend stood up and said, I will not do this. He did everything the right way. He complained to his all his supervisors. He told them what FBI rules were being violated and what policies were not being followed and what constitutional rights of American citizens were being abused. And he was ignored. He was threatened. And he's now, this afternoon, filed a whistleblower complaint with the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz. And he's also been talking to Senator Chuck Grassley and some of the Republicans about his complaints. And he is there. You see his photograph online, 37-year-old man, father of two young children. It took a lot of courage to do this at great risk to himself and blowing up a career he loved.
So there are people inside, as we knew, inside the agency that get it, that don't want to go along with this. Maybe some are afraid to speak up, but some are definitely speaking up. There are whistleblowers on a range of issues, as we know, as we've heard from Chuck Grassley and Jim Jordan and others. Now we have another one. The reporting on this, I don't know what his status is, because the reporting initially was when Friend took this issue to a supervisor, he was immediately fired. His gun and badge were taken. Escort forced him to leave the office and told him not to return to work. So I don't know if that, I guess it was maybe he was fired or maybe he's just on suspension pending a review of his decisions and the whistleblower complaint that he filed with the Inspector General. I'm not sure. But, of course, the larger point is his not wanting to participate in, politicized raids that are being orchestrated by higher-ups at the FBI in service of a political agenda, not in service of equal justice before the law. That's where it's at.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We have a lot to discuss with our friend Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, from Russian nukes to the Iranian uprising to Xi's removal, conspiracy. I mean, conspiracy theories abound, rumors abound. I want to get his take on all that. But first, this 60 Minutes interview that will be poured over by the leftist cable stations, to be sure, for days on end. 60 Minutes interview of Denver Riggleman, who's an ex-Air Force intelligence officer and one-term Republican congressman from Virginia, who was part of the Freedom Caucus when he was in. He was retained by Liz Cheney to be a technical advisor to the January 6th committee. And so he put together his team to collect data and try and identify connections that would explain who did what on January 6th. Here are some of the highlights of what former Congressman Denver Riggleman had to say to 60 Minutes.
Did it hit you at one point that this is way bigger than it appeared in the beginning?
Absolutely. Do you get a real aha moment when you see that the White House switchboard had connected to a rioter's phone while it's happening? That's a big, pretty big aha moment. You get an aha moment.
Wait a minute. Someone in the White House was calling one of the rioters while the riot was going on?
On January 6th, absolutely.
And you know who both ends of that call?
I only know one end of that call. I don't know the White House end, which I believe is more important.
Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, is that an aha moment? Doesn't have text content, just data in these information that he's gathered.
So there's no recording of the actual phone call.
Not recording. I mean, we'll get to it. But his crown jewel is text from former chief of staff Mark Meadows. We'll get to it in a second. But so here's what he did. He categorized six groups of people that, six buckets of people.
Okay.
And then they looked for connects among the six groups to identify the possible conspiracy.
That we looked at, and really it came down to Trump team, Trump family, rally goers, unaffiliated DOJ charged defendants, Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, and others, which are state legislators, alternate electors, things like that.
Mm-hmm. For example, one of the people he identified, just to make it concrete from their perspective, Bianca Garcia, who was part of the Stop the Steal organization.
For example, the data revealed five calls in the weeks before January 6th between the White House and this woman.
We are the storm!
A Stop the Steal activist named Bianca Garcia. The committee obtained this video from the evening of January 5th. Garcia was part of a clandestine meeting with the heads of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, the paramilitary groups that would breach the Capitol the next day.
And, you know, when you have the White House switchboard and certain other cell phone numbers connected to Bianca Garcia, that is a link that needs to be investigated. The thread that needs to be pulled is identifying all the White House numbers and why we have certain specific people, why they were talking to the White House.
I'm no fan of the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers, whatever, but are they paramilitary groups? So the crown jewel, according to Mr. Riggleman,
okay.
The text from Mark Meadows, which provide what he calls irrefutable proof of a conspiracy.
You've called the texts from President Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, the crown jewels. Why?
It was a roadmap. You know, it showed actually the evolution of the beginning arguments from alternate electors all the way through rally planning. All the way to day of. It showed conspiracy theories. It showed the saturation of QAnon.
How'd you get him?
He gave him up.
Do you think it was a mistake?
You know, if you go back to the simplest explanation, I think he wanted to give up some of his text messages. By the way, this is a caveat. We don't know if we got them all. But what we got is pretty valuable.
You have said these texts provide irrefutable, time-stamped proof of a comprehensive plot at all levels of government to overturn the election. Irrefutable.
Early in the text messages, they were talking about alternate electors, you know, I think as soon as November 5th or November 6th.
Right off the bat.
Come on. Right off the bat.
So? Come on. So what? They were talking about a theory. They were making an argument. It was reported in real time. This push for alternate electors, you can disagree or agree with it. How is doing something out in the open and making arguments about whether states should certify or not certify the election results in a particular state, how is that a conspiracy to overthrow the government or overturn an election? You're challenging the legitimacy of the election, and you're doing it openly. What's the conspiracy? Because some people have arguments, because some people believe things that are not supported by the evidence. So what? You're not allowed to do that in America anymore? Otherwise, you're a seditionist? Irrefutable conspiracy. people made arguments saying, I don't believe the election was decided fairly. I don't think it was administered fairly. I think the results are suspect in this community and this and thus this state and this community and thus this state. And so we're going to make arguments about how to rectify it. And we're going to act in furtherance of those arguments. And we're going to do it through courts of law. And we're going to do it through, political machinations in contact with political people in these particular states. I'm missing the insurrection to overthrow the government by illegitimate means, by force, essentially. And you've got grainy photo of Bianca Garcia meeting with, I don't know, a couple of other people. I mean, these are the people that were going to topple the United States government. What are you talking about? And this is, again, the questions are presented breathlessly, and the reporting on this interview will be similarly breathless. I'm not impressed. Sorry, Congressman. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation and author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting, Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, so I have two observations. The first one is this investigation will never have any credibility, ever.
Yeah.
And even if they found something, and the reason it goes back to it started as a witch hunt. It started with finding dots to connect to prove a given thesis, not an investigation. I contrast it many times with the 9/11 Commission, which was incredibly more important and more impactful because it started with a premise of we need to find out what happened and we'll go from there. And it was nonpartisan and it was detailed and it was professional. This is not. So regardless of what they find, they will never have any credibility.
Fruit of the poisonous tree. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that just the points that you just raised demonstrate that it's not a serious investigation, right? It is a witch hunt. The other thing is what a sad commentary on 60 Minutes. If you can think back 20, 30 years ago to the original interviews by Mike Wallace and others, and a typical 60 Minutes interview was a roast. They put a person on the spot. They had questions, and then the person made statements, and then they challenged the premise and the conclusions. What you heard here was essentially, this is a PR stunt.
Yeah.
We're never going to get any prosecutions out of this. This is becoming abundantly clear that this thing is going nowhere at all. And it's going to just end in stupidity. And now, so we're going to throw somebody on 60 Minutes because the 60 Minutes interview is what the whole thing has been for the beginning. It's politics. It's designed to demonize Republicans. There's no difference between this investigation and Joe Biden going before the American people and telling us that half of us are the enemy of democracy. So, go ahead.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah, in case if you watch the 13-minute interview, and you don't have to. This is the service we provide for you. But but if you do. The tell, in case it's not obvious when they're actually talking about the topic at bar, the tell about this being just hagiographic bilge is this interview where they bring the part of the interview, they bring the wife in, they talk about how he lost his reelection in the primary to a more conservative Republican because he officiated a gay wedding for two of his staffers or for a staffer in his significant other, whatever. And he was like, this will blow over, and it didn't blow over. What does that have to do with any? First of all, it's ridiculous. Secondly, what does that have to do with anything about January 6th or your alleged expertise or your interpretation of what you've identified? And by the way, he's got a book out that he's peddling too. But the book piece and the wife and bringing in the gay wedding thing, it's all this is, this is somebody who was with them and now he's against them. So he has credibility to say there was a conspiracy.
I mean, this is how far we've drifted from the original 60 Minutes, which was a grilling to get to the truth. I mean, this is an infomercial. This is like when you go on AGT and some star comes on and they just happen to have a new, series premiering or a new album. it's just PR. But look, they've become addicted to this new mantra, which is if you disagree with me, you're an enemy of democracy.
Yeah.
And, and we just saw another example of that. So we just had an election They elected a new Italian prime minister. She's already been denounced by the European Union and the American press as a fascist. And her crime is she doesn't believe in woke and, you know, a bunch of other things. But it's beyond. I mean, this like CBS saying this is a far right party with fascist roots. I can't remember the last time CBS had a story and they say, and the U.S. Democratic Party, which has roots in slavery.
Yeah.
Right. It's just nuts.
Right.
Right. I mean, actually this government, it's conservative, but it's conservative like the state of Florida or the state of Texas. And you know what? They don't see a difference. If you disagree with them, you are an enemy of democracy. And 60 Minutes is peddling exactly the same narrative.
What about this? Let's start with Xi and the rumors that were swirling around that somehow he had been deposed and he had been locked up as some part of some potential coup. Gordon Chang said the rumors likely untrue. But just even the rumors swirling about such an occurrence, what does that tell us, if anything?
Well, it was a bad weekend to be an authoritarian. You had in China. I mean, look, the whole shtick in China is we are inevitably moving to the future, and we are the great power. And so these kind of rumors of internal discord, they're just amazingly embarrassing and weakening to China's prestige and power. Remember, the alternative model, the West is falling apart, and then people are talking about the leader of China being gotten in a coup. So that's an embarrassment. In Iran, you have protests going against the country, all over the country, and horrible repression, and the protests just keep building. Not likely to come to anything because we've seen this before. It'll be violently repressed. But the fact is, the Iranian regime's a little busy today. And in Russia, you have this unbelievable mobilization, which has just created demonstrations all over the country. And men trying to flee the country. Again, how embarrassing is talking to a guy from Azerbaijan, because there's visa-free travel between Russia and Azerbaijan. A one-way ticket to Baku is $10,000.
Wow. Hmm. Well, yeah, how many have fled? Because he called up, what, 300,000?
300,000. And people are just bailing up Finland. And, you know, again, regardless, it's just incredibly embarrassing. So these regimes, which are better than democracy, stronger than us, you know, the future of history, they've had the kind of their worst PR weekend ever. Joe Biden wouldn't know that, by the way, because I think he was at the beach.
And what about this prospect of Putin using limited nuclear weapons to, you know, shock and awe is his way out of his problems, and what that would mean if he did?
Yeah, well, I like anybody else, I don't know if he will or he won't. What I will say is, use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine is not going to turn out favorably for the Russians, and there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, I was in the military for 25 years. You do what's called fire and maneuver, right? So the purpose of dropping a bomb or a hand grenade or a nuclear weapon, doesn't matter, is that fire destroys or suppresses something that then allows you to maneuver to some objective. It's not clear there's anywhere in the theater where the Russians can do that. First of all, the Russian military is probably completely untrained to operate in a nuclear environment. It's very, very likely that if there's a mushroom cloud, half the Russian army will just jump up and run away. So that's not very likely. I was just in Ukraine. These people are not going anywhere. You drop a nuclear weapon at them, they're not going to stop fighting. Matter of fact, they're going to fight harder. And they'll probably get a lot more weapons from the U.S. and other countries to do that. And let's be honest, if Russia thinks it's isolated now, if Russia drops a nuclear weapon on another country, what nation in the world is going to try to make an excuse, except for China, try to make an excuse for Russia? So even countries that are doing business with the Russians now, because they really don't have any choice, because they're just trying to not make anybody angry, they're going to have to stop. And so Russia, they will go from being what they are today to basically being another North Korea. I don't know if Putin can survive that.
Would that necessitate a military response from us?
No, because it's, again, Ukraine is not a treaty ally of NATO. There might be some residual radiation which would pass over the borders. But look, nobody really knows the long-term health effects of low-dose radiation. So a lot of people might be really scared, but is it really a military threat or a consequential? Probably not. So, no. If you dropped a nuclear weapon on NATO territory, I think NATO would fire a nuclear weapon back. I don't think they'd, I don't think they'd start World War III, but they would fire a nuclear weapon back. And then where's Russia going to be then? I mean, so he doesn't have a lot of options, and none of them are really very good.
Do the people I know that you're just in Ukraine, were any Russian soldiers just dropping their weapons and walking away?
I was not in areas where there were active shooting, so I can't tell you that. And the Ukrainians, they don't give you a lot of, details about operational activities at the front. I mean, they're happy to talk about the aid and how it's going and stuff like that, but they don't discuss tactical matters. So, I mean, they won't even tell you how many POWs they have.
With all this going on in China, Iran, Russia, I was happy to see the Department of Defense announcing Friday that its inaugural slate of members to its Defense Advisory Committee on Diversity and Inclusion. Retired General Lester Lyles will chair that committee, which is composed of civilian women and men appointed by SecDef to provide advice and recommendations on matters of and policies relating to the improvement of racial, ethnic diversity, inclusion, equal opportunity with the department with the primary focus on military personnel. It's such an honor, he said, to be appointed to this lofty post, this important work. We really have our eye on the ball in the military.
Look, I mean, the one thing that's become very clear, for years, the left talked about social justice and policy and equity. And these were terms that sounded very comforting and friendly. And people said, oh, we could have a reasonable discussion about what this represents. But the reality is, these things, just like climate policy, are a political agenda that is incredibly subversive and destructive. And it's designed to exert political control, not deliver better energy policy or economic policy or defense policy. And not only do they not do that, they're oblivious to the collateral damage that they inflict on organizations. And so this diversity project in the U.S. military is adverse to morale. It's hurting recruiting. It's hurting readiness and capabilities. It's actually making military service less desirable. So at a time in which the world is getting more dangerous, when it's more difficult to recruit, we push forward on a political objective. A contrasting example. In the end of the day, as much as we should have done it before, when we completely integrated the military, that was done out of military necessity. I mean, we just needed the manpower, right? There was no choice in doing that. They weren't driving social change, right? And when they brought people into the military, it was about training people that when you looked at a uniform, the only thing you saw was that name tag. You didn't see black or white or man or woman or anything else. This diversity and equity trade is exactly the opposite of that. It's making every soldier a victim, every soldier entitled, every soldier something different from the other person. It is exactly the opposite of what you want to do to instill in good order and discipline, teamwork, and efficiency in a military organization. So you're putting the objective, and here's the biggest thing. You're putting those kids' lives at risk. Mm-hmm. Because every time you do something, what takes them away from their primary job, which is getting ready to fight next to each other in battle, you're making it more likely they will get killed and maimed. So just like when you do these things in school and the big victim with your COVID policies is the kids don't get educated, but it's okay because it's the political agenda. When you do these things in the military, you're going to get people killed.
He is the Heritage Foundation's Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. More and more Chicagoans getting mugged by reality, literally. Yeah. We've got another instance of an attempted kidnapping in the West Loop that happened over the weekend.
Yeah, it happened Saturday night. Less than a month on the first abduction. Remember the guy who was walking his dog who had bear spray? Sprayed the man who was attempting to kidnap a woman. This time, the woman started screaming and a Lyft driver got out of his car. And she was able to escape. But now people are waking up to what's really going on. Here's Julie Darling, who is in charge of the West Loop Community Group.
Now this has become very scary. I am not one to be an alarmist, but at this point, it does very much upset me. It's very unnerving, and I'm really urging my neighbors and my friends to walk together, carry some sort of self-defense, pepper spray, mace. The first line of self-defense is being aware.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the guy pulled up in a maroon minivan, and police are still looking for him.
This is why the Chicago Press Corps is, in part why, so antagonistic to the newspapers that are being put out. Because they've been part of supporting the policies that and the policymakers that have brought about this lawlessness, this unchecked violence in Chicago and Cook County. And now it's coming statewide because of the Purge Law, or the Safety Act, as the Orwellians term it. And this was, remember, passed without any debate, without any media scrutiny, without any coverage.
It happened in the middle of the night, too. While people were sleeping.
Yeah, the media was sleeping.
Right.
The Chicago Press Corps. They're not. They're asleep at the switch because they serve as the comm shop for the people in charge. So if you're going to scale what we're doing in Chicago and Cook County statewide, all the better. The problem is they can't allow themselves to be exposed and complicit in all this because you're seeing a revolt across the political spectrum against what's happening in Chicago and Cook County and the prospect of it coming to the suburbs and exurbs and the rest of the state when the jails start getting emptied out, or at least half emptied out, as you're hearing from county sheriffs. We talked to the Winnebago County Sheriff last week, who said exactly that, as you're hearing from mayors in the suburbs like Tinley Park and Oak Lawn. Having a lot of Democrats get mugged by reality. Our next guest is one of those. Happened a while back for him. Dennis Byrne is a native Chicagoan, longtime journalist who was variously an op-ed columnist, editorial board member. This guy actually once sat on the editorial board of the Chicago Sun-Times, if you can believe it, before it was the AFL-CIO NPR Times. He also wrote on science, transportation, and urban affairs for the Tribune, Sun-Times, and Chicago Daily News. He blogs at The Barbershop and is the author of the historical novel Madness, The War of 1812. And I commissioned him to write a little book for, Illinois residents. And he did. It's a little book that's being mailed out to many, many people. Some have started to receive it. Others will receive it. It's called The Governor You Don't Know, What Every Illinoisan Should Know. And just the opening graph to set up our conversation with Dennis. I can't remember exactly when I was no longer a committed and loyal Democrat. And we'll just leave it there and tell us when it started. Dennis Byrne, again, The Governor You Don't Know. And if you don't get a copy of the book in the mail, you can download it at PritzkerBook.com. PritzkerBook.com. You can read it chapter by chapter. You can read the whole thing in a PDF. It's a quick read. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So just to talk a little bit about this and just to set the table, as I mentioned, we commissioned you, my PAC commissioned you to write this book. So just want to disclose that up front because the way we operate is we disclose things. We operate transparently as opposed to those who run around preaching transparency who don't. And so how you want to present yourself as having done this work for my PAC?
Let's go back a few years. I was a committed Democrat. I came out of college, liberal and all that. And I voted for every Democrat presidential candidate from LBJ up to, I didn't vote for Ron Reagan. But then things started to change. As an editorial board member, I had to be able to defend the argument that I was making. And the cracks quickly appeared that I couldn't defend what the Democratic Party was doing as it moved further and further to the left. And it seemed, from my reader's response at least, that that was being criticized for being a conservative liberal. So I could live with the labels they give me. But I did find that the Democratic Party had left me, and, although I had left them. So this opportunity came along to tell my story of how I changed and the difficulties I found and the rewards that I found. And the primary example that I picked to say why I switched, what the policies were that prompted me to switch, was Governor Pritzker. He has demonstrated that he is, an acolyte of the woke left. When you get down and look at his policies, you find that they no longer represent the Democratic Party that I knew, John JFK represented. I always admired JFK. I read all his speeches. He moved away from the wing that Dr. Martin Luther King represented when he said, the color of skin doesn't matter. Well, now we see Democrats saying the color of the skin matters all. If you're white-skinned and a child, you're going to be a racist. So I took a look at his policies from the active safety legislation to decide, and what he did to the students and the parents of this state by shutting down the schools and imposing all these terrible things on.
Well,
on
Mr. Berner, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, that's chapter three, and reading it is giving me like hives to relive. You know, what you had to watch the child abuse going on with your kids. I had two boys that, you know, were locked out for years. And then when they did go back, it was 2 days a week, it was just 12 days total for a whole school year. But the research was available in November 2021, yet Pritzker ignored it. What research was he ignoring?
Well, the research is actually pretty solid, and it's about the damage that the lockdowns and the various regulations were doing to the children. Apparently, the people who imposed these lockdowns and the mask requirements and the distance and remote learning, they didn't take into account other costs, the social economic costs, of locking down not just the schools, but the entire economy. I mean, you can't lock down an entire economy and expect things to go, swimmingly, everything's fine. Or as Biden would say now, we're on the up road. The research found that there was terrible and lasting damage done to children. It's not just in academics, but in their social development. I guess there was a most extreme example was suicide, and that they found that was up. And you know, I think it's unconscionable that a governor Pritzker, who is representing the liberal view, would adopt such autocratic and damaging things that affect every person in the state. My God, I've been around for a long time, and I've never seen any political act, public policy decision, legislation that affected directly so many people as Pritzker has. Even adults, you can't go here, you must go there, you can't eat, the people who are serving you in the restaurants, They got to be fired. Everybody's got to close up. Well, maybe you can have a few people over for Thanksgiving dinner if I say it's okay. And he is still doing this. He's claiming the emergency powers that he originally had that expired every 30 days, and he would have knew that. And that would give him all these powers. And I've never seen this before. And unfortunately, the Democratic-controlled legislature and the blue state voters just don't seem to understand how far we have traversed from what I consider to be the moderate Democrat and the moderate viewpoints.
Well, and you go through this sort of chapter and verse from crime to COVID to matters economic to K through 12 education, school choice to your closing paragraph, just sort of summing up what you think we can expect if we're Pritzker to be reelected. And you write, to make a change means taking a risk. It means many of you will have to temporarily step outside of your old political comfort zone. To not make a change also entails risk. In fact, hoping things get better with the same people pursuing the same destructive policies outlined in this book is actually the most hopeless choice of all. Hope and hopelessness. Why do you have hope that sort of centrist, center-left voters in Illinois might make a change this time around when change has been so difficult in the city and state, as you know?
Well, hope is the right word. I can't guarantee that it's going to happen. I think once people learn the facts and are educated about what's really happening, instead of depending on their ideology or party loyalty or self-interest because they're hired by a government agency, I think if people could look beyond that and look directly at what the issues are, they may say, okay, this isn't working. We need to, let's go to a purple state. Or maybe just consider that the opposition candidates have something to say instead of mocking them and accusing them of being extremists.
He is Dennis Byrne. He's a former Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times columnist. The book that he wrote, these are his opinions. The governor you don't know, the governor you do not know, to be quite specific, what every Illinoisan should know. You can get the book. A lot of you are going to get it mailed to you. You can also download it at PritzkerBook.com. PritzkerBook.com is the website. Dennis Byrne, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, had some fun with numbers again the other day, speaking to the leftist lemmings about gas prices. He said the following.
And in 41 states, plus the District of Columbia, the average gasoline price is less than $2.99.
What? Completely untrue. What? It's just completely made up. There are zero states with an average gas price of $2.99 or less. In fact, prices remain $1.31 a gallon higher than when Biden took office. Zero states. He said there are 41 states plus D.C. There's actually zero. So that's a rounding error.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Really?
Rounding error.
Well, what does he think he's going to get away with those lies?
Here's a little bit more color, though, on where we stand under Biden's green stagflation. This from a favorite financial commentator, Joel Ross, writing in his Ross Rant newsletter. If you still think inflation has peaked and will be back to 2 or 3% late next year, you do not have any understanding of what is really happening. The world is in the worst crisis since 1938. and the Dems are making it much worse than it could be. And he goes through, of course, a compilation of data and metrics because these are for his investor subscribers. He talked about the experts in a variety of fields that he has spoken with and top experienced investors who I talk to daily. Almost every one of these people are as negative as they have ever been. The most important thing, the Fed is admitting inflation remains high and will remain higher for longer, and they will not see inflation back at 2% until 2025. That's with the 75 basis point increase. And don't forget, we're scheduled for another 75 point bump in October and another 50 point bump in December. So we've got another 125 point basis point increase before the year's end in terms of current expectations. Those could change. Rates will remain up for an extended period. It's way too early to be a stock buyer other than energy and a select few other stocks. Home prices will continue to soften but not crash. The dollar is at a 20-year high and could go higher, exacerbating the financial problems in many other nations. You just saw the report, the pound, the British pound, is at its weakest value in relation to the dollar. The two-year is now in a place that's getting attractive as a place to hide. 4.1% is a nice return these times. The problem is it may go to a higher yield, lower price as the Fed raises another 75 in October, 50 in December. The 1 year might be a better place, but we'll see. Settle into your cave. We have a very long way to go before things turn up. Don't lose focus on geopolitics and November, as they will impact things much more than the Fed funds rate. Well, there's an important line. Don't lose focus on the geopolitics and November. In other words, the policymakers you choose in November are going to have a lot bigger impact on how much pain, economic pain, is going to be inflicted than is the Fed. Don't rely on Jay Powell and the mystics at the Fed to work you out of this. You have to get better policymakers in D.C. and at the state level making better policy. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute and author of Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's always good to be here, and thanks you for your commentary at the beginning there. Very interesting.
Yeah, and Ross and others have gone on, too, to point out just how, speaking of better policymakers making better policy, the energy policies of this administration and so many in the Western world are creating exponentially more damage in the lives of regular people than is otherwise necessary. But, I mean, you know, that's what they did with the lockdowns, too.
A great crisis like this one needs a number of solutions, right? And you look back to 1979, and there was Volcker, and he tightened money, and that was great. But at the same time, we had a new growth agenda. We were dealing with new deregulation in trucking and in energy and in telecommunications. We had a new president taking office who was promising dramatic reductions in capital gains taxes and taxes in general, and there was a real emphasis on growth. And those two things worked together. You had the tightened monetary policy helped solve the inflation problem. But you have to mitigate against the recessionary drives of these sort of increases in interest rates with a growth agenda. That was the radical contribution of the Reagan years. That was David Stockman. That was George Gilder. You know, that was Art Laffer and so on. The supply siders convinced the Reagan administration that this is true, and they were having to go against economic orthodoxy, and it turned out to be exactly right. And that's what saved this country and arguably gave us, you know, many decades forward of a general, you know, expectation of economic growth. And so that's really critical to understanding. What you have today is a Fed that's trying to, a little bit, you know, making efforts to replicate that sort of Volcker war on inflation without any kind of pressure from the other end towards economic growth. In fact, we're seeing exactly the opposite. And so, as a result, you have really a kind of the makings of a man-made depressionary inflation for the next year or two or three or four or five. It's really a disaster, and it's not clear the White House has any clue about this at all. In fact, I think they're resisting any kind of growth agenda
on ideological grounds, or maybe, you know, there's the full-scale crazy people have taken over, and they just want ready to dismantle the totality of industrial civilization. That seems to be the conclusion you would come to if you just evaluate the Biden administration's policies.
Yeah, they really don't care about inflation. They care more about climate change. And right now, you know, the average household is going to spend $4,200 more because of inflation with gas prices and food prices. And so you're telling me that this could last 3 to 4 years?
At the current situation, because, again, we're nowhere near stopping this inflation. And just to be clear, I mean, you can actually understand this through the data. You have to get, for Federal Reserve policy to have a real impact on inflation, in other words, driving it down. And I don't mean reversing the inflation of the last 2 years. I mean just stopping the increased growth of damage, right? I mean, nobody is thinking that we're going to go back to where we were 2 years ago. These listeners need to understand that. These prices that we're living with now are not going to go back to where they were 2 years ago. Even at zero inflation now, that just means, you know, the index would freeze at its current position. Okay, so, you know, I don't think that people understand this. But we're not even talking about a result that good. I mean, there's a lot of excess liquidity out there that was pumped up during the lockdown that needs to become endemic like a virus. And the Fed is really not anywhere near getting to where it needs to be. By that, I mean it's real interest rates in the short term right now need to be in the positive realm, which is to say that you need federal funds rates to be above the existing rate of inflation. So that's, let's say, it's 8%, 8.5%. You need rates to be 9 or 10% now. And we're nowhere near that point. You understand what I mean? I mean, like, the Fed's pretending to wage this war on inflation, but they haven't gotten anywhere near serious yet. I understand why they're going slowly, but if they really want to take it on, they're going to have to go a lot further. If they want to reproduce what Volcker did, you've got to get really serious.
Volcker with the tight money, but also the Fed needs to sell its bond portfolio, and they haven't even begun to do that.
No, they're nowhere near doing that. So what you get is the worst aspect of this kind of policy, which is crashes in the housing market, right? But with no attempt to kind of heal the wounds or stop the bleeding with some kind of growth agenda. They're doing exactly the opposite. And it's especially annoying when you hear Biden telling you that it's not so bad, you know. Yeah, gas prices are down relative to what they were 6 months ago, but I don't, you know, you check your utility bills. I mean, you know, every other form of energy production is skyrocketing. Utility bills right now, which means electricity, water, natural gas, are up for average consumers at a rate of 14.4% year over year right now, which everybody knows. Everybody who's listening to this knows this because they saw their electric bill. And everybody in households started screaming at each other, "Who's been leaving the lights on?"
and by the way, you know, just the idea we haven't reached peak inflation necessarily. We also haven't reached peak gas prices either. I mean, there's a lot of analysts predicting that oil is going to rise again in October, gas possibly as well, and heating oil is going to go through the roof. So, yeah. You know, so it's going to be very interesting especially in the context of a global recession like you were discussing. Boy, I tell you, if people get to a position where they're having trouble getting food or staying warm, then you really got a volatile situation.
And that is exactly the position that you've got going on in England. Everybody of means has already moved. You know that, right? I mean, they're taking off to Spain or whatever, just getting out because they can't afford to heat their homes. And that's you know, what's happening in the UK right now could happen here. And it could happen soon after the election as we approach the winter months. It's a mess. And keep in mind, too, that you've got masses of people who have already spent their savings from 2020 when they got all those fake infusions of cash from the government. Those are long gone, spent and then also eaten away by inflation. And now
you have savings rates going down to historic lows right now. At the same time, people are digging really deep into their credit portfolios and running up credit card debt, which is and paying 20-25% interest. These are catastrophic decisions that people are making, but they're doing this because they're trying to hold on to some semblance of a standard of living that they remember from just 3 years ago. But it's eating away very quickly, very rapidly at the very foundations of the possibility of continued growth and prosperity.
I wanted to update you on something I know you're concerned about, as we all are. He's fine.
Who?
He's fine.
Who's fine?
What do you mean, who? Who else could I be talking about? Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla.
Oh.
He tested positive for COVID,
no.
But he's feeling well and he's symptom-free. Albert Bourla is fine. Jeffrey, he's fine.
I don't understand this guy. What if he has no symptoms? Why was he testing himself? Do you just wake up in the morning and go, "Oh, I wonder if I have COVID," and then grab your rapid test and then tweet it out? I don't understand what is going on with this guy.
Right, he added in his tweet.
Has he been vaccinated?
Thank you for asking.
Six times.
I've not had the new bivalent booster yet, as I was following CDC guidelines to wait 3 months since my previous COVID case, which was back in mid-August. Well, we've made great progress. The virus is still with us, Jeffrey, and so is Albert Bourla.
Wow, we've made great progress, but no thanks to him, I'm sorry to say. And this is widely admitted now. The failure of these vaccines is actually, for me, one of the great... It's been one of the great sort of shocks, right? I mean, we were promised a vaccine of 95% efficacy, although they never explained exactly what that meant. And then it turns out, of course, it doesn't stop infection. It doesn't stop spread. And then all the data we're seeing right now is that the highly vaccinated are the people more likely to get and suffer from COVID. So, I mean, it's hard to say there's any world in which these vaccines have been a success at all. By any standard, and now you're seeing systematic efforts to sort of suppress all news of adverse effects of vaccines, although everybody in their own lives knows about this stuff. We all know people who have suffered from these vaccines, which, it makes it all the worse that they were mandated for vast swaths of the population that they got them, and it was supposed to get us out of the pandemic. It seems like it prolonged it, and the problem of original antigenic sin seems to be ubiquitous these days. This is a phenomenon in which vaccines, repeated uses of the same vaccine, just ends up sort of hardwiring your immune system to resist one pathogen and disable it towards everything else. So you get on net worse health outcomes. And so this seems to be what's going on here. I honestly cannot imagine a combination of factors more sort of coming together to create, the overwhelming public sense that we have been bamboozled, snookered, robbed, pillaged, subject to appalling levels of despotism for an unworkable policy. This is the emerging consensus that you're seeing in the public, and it's intensifying by the day. And I can just tell you, I speak to groups all around the country whenever I can get out and do it. And I've just never encountered in my life anything like the level of anger and fury and sense of betrayal that you're seeing out there among mainstream people. And I'm not talking about people who come to hear me speak because of their interest in the lockdown issue or the COVID policy. They're coming to hear because, they're looking for some guidance forward on finance and economics.
Yeah, we're all.
And then I talk about the COVID thing, and wow, just people are very, very, very angry. And I don't care how many mainstream news people keep saying, just stop talking about the lockdown. It's just no big deal anymore. Nonsense. This is the issue of our time. It was our World War I, and people have been so severely harmed and traumatized by what happened just 2.5 years ago and continuing. There is going to be hell to pay. It's fundamentally changed American political life.
I hope there'll be hell to pay for the COVIDians as people are going to be picking through this wreckage for years to come. Jeffrey Tucker, yeah. Founder, president of the Brownstone Institute, author of Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss Freedom Summit Chicago on November 5th. Get your tickets today before they sell out. Go to freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week it was Greg Gutfeld and his crew on Fox picking up our discussion of the Purge Law in Illinois, as it's being properly called online, or the Safety Act, as the Orwellians in the state call it. More recently now, Joe Rogan, the most popular podcaster on the planet, he addressed the issue. His guest with him while he was talking about is a filmmaker named Will Harris, who's actually an Illinois native, and he sort of chimed in as Rogan was going through it. Take a listen.
The crazy purge, the safety law. It's they're essentially eliminating cash bail for almost everything dangerous. Kidnapping, they're eliminating cash bail for second-degree murder. They're eliminating cash bail for murder through narcotics. So you could, like, overdose someone and drug them to death and no cash bail. Intimidating an official, like a federal official. Or here it is. Here's the things. The law includes secondary murder, arson, so you could light a guy's house on fire, get right out of jail, drug-induced homicide, robbery, kidnapping, aggravated battery, burglary, intimidation, aggravated driving under the influence, fleeing and eluding drug offenses, and threatening a public official. No bail.
What? I'm from Illinois.
It's crazy. I mean, everyone's freaking out. I'm very concerned about the increase in violent crime. Again, I do want to stress there's still time to fix it. The state's attorneys are working very hard. We have been for the last year and a half to fix this law. It's very fixable. We could still eliminate cash bail, but make sure the right people are in custody and everybody who's not in danger gets out, said state's attorney Robert Berlin. Yeah, they're f***ed.
Yeah, we're blanked if we choose to let ourselves be blanked. Or we can unblank ourselves. And the way you do that is not by going to the people that crafted this legislation because they had a particular perspective in mind when they did it. And they're just trying to buy time through the election. There is no good faith effort afoot to change this law in any sensible way so that it puts protecting law-abiding residents of Illinois first. That's a fact. And by the way, ironically, one of the leading spokesmen for this law, Cam Buckner, who's one of the mayoral candidates come February, by the way. You know, of course he's a proponent of this law. This guy's been convicted of two DUIs.
Wow.
Yeah. New York did a similar thing, you know, with de Blasio and Cuomo when those two Sandinistas were in charge of the state. And there's some data coming in now on how it's worked out in New York. This from Charles Fain Lehman over at City Journal. Last week, New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services quietly dropped a bombshell. For months, the state had avoided releasing much-needed data on individuals who were arraigned in New York before lawmakers passed bail reform. But newly available data confirm what critics have long argued. Bail reform, meaning no cash bail, was followed by a significant increase in criminal reoffending. So let this be a canary in the coal mine for you. People who are content to just be satisfied with what those people in charge continue to tell you, which runs completely afoul of what you're seeing and hearing and what we know from the experience of other states that have done the same. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Jason Rantz. He's the host of the Jason Rantz Show on KTTH 770 AM in Seattle, Tacoma. He's Seattle's leading conservative commentator. And of course, he's had plenty of experience talking about this topic. You know, it was former Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin who had her summer of love when that city was sacked. just like we're having our summer of joy under Lori Lightfoot right now. Jason, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How are things going in Seattle and the greater Seattle and Portland in particular, the big cities out your way, given what we saw? I guess their profile has diminished a little bit because Chicago and New York's has increased in terms of the lawlessness, but mm-hmm. I assume you're still struggling with some of the same issues.
Yeah, things are not going well. You have both Portland and Seattle hitting record high homicide and violent crime rates. And we could have seen this coming. We did see this coming. We called it out at the time. It turns out when you defund the police, when you change laws that allow for criminals to feel emboldened because you're basically allowing them to get away with pretty much anything, well, guess what? That's exactly what they do, is they increase their criminal behavior. And so we're seeing it across the board. And it's, you know, we have our version of a Chicago Monday after a weekend, either a long weekend or a regular weekend of crime. You guys obviously, from a numbers perspective, have more, but we have a certain expectation in the Pacific Northwest. We don't expect to have three or four shootings. We don't expect to have that. And when we see every single Monday going over the weekend that we pretty much have those stats, it's clearly saying we're going in the wrong direction. And we expect, well, last year we hit a 25-year high homicide rate in Seattle. We almost certainly will hit that by the end of this year, exceed that by the end of this year. Same thing in Portland. Portland is having another high year. There is no end in sight.
Well, and, like, you know, we had 34 shootings, 6 killed this weekend, which is, you know, if we had 3 shootings over a weekend, that would make news. But tell us about, you know, who championed this, Black Lives Matter, and how it grew out of a progressive ideology.
Literally every single Democrat in power. I mean, and I'm not even exaggerating. There were no Democrats either at the time, and really up until recently, who did not embrace the BLM movement and the policies that came out of it. So what we had happen at the state level was the Democrats, who have total control at the Capitol, they passed a series of laws that changed policing. They banned vehicular pursuits in almost every single instance. So the only way that a cop can actually pursue some criminal in a vehicle is if they have probable cause that a violent felony had occurred. Well, to get probable cause pretty much in this circumstance would mean the cop would have to witness it. It is a very, very high bar. You can get reasonable suspicion really easily, and then you establish probable cause. So unless you're physically witnessing a violent crime, a guy or woman can get into a car and then just drive away. And that's why we've seen a surge in smash-and-grab robberies. Anything that is relatively quick to do, if you're in and out in a few minutes, and really you can go up to 10 minutes depending on where you are, because our police departments are so unpopulated at this point. We have staffing crises all across the state. As long as you're in and out, you know that you're not going to be chased. And for the most part, these are people who are in stolen vehicles, so they know that the investigation – probably won't go anywhere if they're even just a little bit careful.
Yeah, you make an important connection here too, and what you're describing is something we're very familiar with, unsurprisingly. But that it started 2 years ago. It started with defund the police, yep. And then defund police brings you to decarcerate the criminals. It's not, you know, where did this come from? Yeah, Black Lives Matter, which is just a vehicle for the new Marxists. And then it was first police and now prosecutors, because they're into destabilizing, if not undermining, the rules of the game, the law and order in this country.
Yeah, and I don't even know what the rules are at this point, because we're going so easy on criminals after they actually are caught. Maybe they get charged, usually not. Usually they get put into restorative justice programs or diversion programs, any kind of alternative to the quote-unquote racist criminal justice system that's steeped in white supremacy. So this whole idea of dismantling the criminal justice system and then rebuilding it in the vision of a BLM activist, that is happening and has happened across the country, because it's not just Chicago and the Pacific Northwest. We are seeing this in a lot of places, including some right-leaning cities or conservative cities, where folks don't quite understand that there is a small group of people who have a heck of a lot of power who have been changing these systems. And so now we're not going to charge. Now we're going to say, including in violent crime, we're going to put you in some alternative justice program or social justice program where they're clearly not going to get the help or the punishment that they deserve, and they're just going to recommit. And that's why we see such a huge prolific crime problem. Most cities will tell you, or most police chiefs in cities will tell you, it's a small number of people who are responsible for the vast majority of the crime.
Right.
Now, that's not always the case, but that's usually the case.
Right.
And it's usually the case because we're not punishing the people after we catch them.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And that's exactly what we're experiencing here and the conversation we're trying to drive. And in Washington State in particular, speaking of what's happening in Seattle and then the implications statewide, what are the chances that this could lead to an upset in the Senate? I've seen some polling over the last couple of weeks that Patty Murray's opponent, longtime incumbent there, Tiffany Smiley, is within a few points of her. And I wonder if the public safety, personal safety issue is driving some potential surprises out your way.
Well, we certainly hope so. It's not going to be easy for Tiffany Smiley. Washington State is very, very, very blue. And you've got, it was a hit piece that masqueraded as a news story. It was an editorial in the Seattle Times going after Tiffany Smiley for what you just said, highlighting some of the crime problems in Seattle. And they want you to believe in the Seattle Times, oh, all is well. There's no issues whatsoever.
Yeah.
Ignore Tiffany Smiley here. This is the old tactic from the GOP.
Right.
But it's just like, no, the data is very clearly on our side. But there are so many people in Seattle in particular who have to be seeing everything that's happening. They refuse to acknowledge it. There is a large portion of activists in our community who refuse to acknowledge the problems, in part because they're the ones responsible. They're the ones who are responsible for the policies that have been passed. And you've got the Seattle City Council at this point. There was also a story in the Times basically trying to compare where they stood when they supported 50% defunding and where they stand now. And while some have changed, and credit to them, I guess, but many of them are still using exactly the same rhetoric. So I don't know how, in order to win a statewide office, statewide campaign here, you have to win about 40% of King County, where Seattle is located. That's not easy.
We're living parallel lives, you and us, Jason. You know, one thing I noticed, too, the Wall Street Journal opined on this. I thought it was sort of interesting last week. In Portland now, they talk specifically about liquor stores being the subject of you know, historically high robberies. Just the zeroing in on liquor stores in the land of the land governed by Antifa. Can you provide more insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the same thing. Number one, they know that there are little consequences for these kinds of crimes. Unless you're stealing felony-level amount of products, and even then, frankly, it's not a guarantee. But unless you're doing felony-level, you're not going to spend any time in jail. Number two, the Portland Police Department is dramatically understaffed. So the chances of an officer being able to respond while you're still there is very, very slim. A lot of this is also being driven by juvenile crime, which gets no punishment whatsoever, and gang-related crime, also tied to juvenile, which is just out of control. And so you have all of these policies and a lack of staff that's just creating this perfect storm that allows these criminals to feel emboldened. Again, if you're in and out, you're going to be okay as far as law enforcement. You just will not be arrested. Cops can't get there, and you won't be charged even if they were there.
He is Jason Rantz, host of The Jason Rantz Show on KTTH 770 AM in Seattle, Tacoma. Seattle's leading conservative commentator. Jason, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.